Escape from Plan A for this week. We've been meaning to do this for a while, guys. It's really nice to have both of you on. Chong, how's it going?
Hi, how are you? I'm good.
And Fred.
Hey, how's it going, all?
We have talked about this for a while because it sounded like, I think Chong, you told me this in person once. You're like, you should get Fred on.
Yeah.
To talk about higher ed. And I was like, I think you want to talk to him about higher ed because both of you are actually similarly placed working in sort of like public universities.
Yes.
And there's a, you know, it seems like right now there's a time where, you know, I'm from like a government family, you know, like all my parents worked in the government. My sister works in the government. My wife works in the government. And we all went to like public universities, and it just seems like a time where there is an all-out assault on public institutions, whether it's a university or government sector or whatever it is, not just budgetary, but like ideological, like hatred of anyone that draws a public salary is seen as like a leech. It's really disturbing to see. But on the other hand, I get where the frustration is coming from as well. So anyway, just wanted to start there. I don't really have any plans for this discussion, but it's nice to have both of you on. So Chong, what's on your mind when it comes to?
Yeah, well, in DMs, I kind of joked with Fred saying like, you're successful and I'm not, because I never made it to a tenure track position. But in fact, I am the majority. So the majority of PhDs who graduate now do not find full-time employment. Well, at least tenure track employment. So over the past, I don't know, I feel like 2008 was the cliff. I mean, it was coming for a long time. But yeah, it's completely fallen off a cliff to where, you know, enrollments are down. COVID certainly didn't help. And then after 2008, a lot of the older professors who would have retired, of course, you know, they're worried about the future, about their pensions and stuff. So they stayed on. So now you have this situation where these schools, 50 to maybe 65% of them are taught by contingent faculty. And that's where I am. So it is really frustrating because I'm on the inside as a faculty member, but I'm also on the outside. And most people are like me. And I don't think when people think about, you know, higher ed faculty, even on TV shows, even in fictional depictions, they show a guy or a woman in a big office with tweed jacket and elbow patches. And that's just, that hasn't been the case since like the 1970s. It really is a mirror of disaster capitalism. It's a pyramid scheme. And I kind of wish I'd never gone to school that way. Sometimes I wish I would have just been like an accountant or something. But yeah, that's where I'm at on all of this.
And I think, Chong, that is really important background information and just brute facts that we should get out there immediately. So thank you for providing that sort of lead in. Mm-hmm. And I would say, yes, I am differently situated. I don't know about all this success and the like, but it is true that my employment is much more secure as tenure track. And at this point, tenured faculty.
Congrats.
And yeah, my understanding is it's the minority that are now in this position, and it's been a reversal of the old trend. So I'm not exactly sure. I didn't do a lot of research coming into this discussion. Apologies. But I'm pretty sure that if you backed us up 50 years, the proportions of tenure track to non-tenure track would have been reversed. So the majority of faculty would have been at least on the tenure track. That means with the possibility of attaining tenure, and the minority would be on the non-tenure track. This is sometimes called visiting adjunct. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are other titles for this. And so, yeah, one question here is why this labor situation has flipped around. Okay, because that's definitely part of the broader crisis of the university. It's not so much that these institutions are not financially viable, just the opposite. Some data came out with the Chronicle of Higher Ed, I believe, today, where university presidents were being surveyed. 85% of university presidents said that they are very confident that their institutions will be financially viable over the next 5 to 10 years. So it's not that there's no money.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm right. kind of and, getting at?
Yeah. And so, they've never been compensated more, these presidents.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. The upper management or the higher level administration is doing just fine.
Yeah.
So part of this actually has to do with how the resources that are still coming into the university are being allocated. And yeah, definitely part of this story has to do with the expansion of the administration and the rendering more and more insecure of the teaching faculty and the research faculty.
Yeah, so, absolutely. So thinking about... like you mentioned on our Google Doc, administrative bloat and managers. I mean, part of that, I mean, they say it's because, you know, enrollment's down, and of course states are just kicking less money into these institutions. So they have to find a way to make up for it. So one of the ways they say, okay, well, we need to recruit more. So how to attract more students? So then you have just astronomical bloat. I read a statistic that from the 70s until now, full-time administrators and all of these other professionals increased by something like 400%. And at some schools, I think MIT, Johns Hopkins, you've got 7 to 9 times more administrators than faculty. And then at some schools, you've got like 5 administrators for every student. And a couple of schools have more non-faculty members than students total. So you think some of these schools, say you have like 5,000 students. I mean, come on. It's just ridiculous. And some of the school, like the higher ups, the executive levels. So before they would farm them from, you know, academia. They'd be PhD professors, researchers, people who actually spent time in the classroom. Now, like Florida Atlantic University hired the executive vice president of a private prison company, and they moved his salary up to like $1.5 million. And he was CEO of a prison company that made like $2 billion a year.
That's almost poetic. My God.
No, it's too on the nose. On the nose. Like, you don't even need to read Foucault to understand that. So, so there you go. Like, this is where we're at. And
wait, Chong. Yes. Okay. So I've long wondered why that happened. That's happened. It was the it's been the subject of quite a bit of discussion.
Yeah.
And I confess, like, I don't quite understand the dynamic you just laid out. What is the bottom line as to why
administrative bloat?
Yeah, like what is causing that?
Well, one hypothesis is, so they needed new sources of revenue. State governments and the feds just kind of gave up on funding them, right? Including tuition, fees, all of that in their budget. So they're looking for new sources. And one of the ways that they do that is by asking for money from, you know, donors, you know, facility, better, so-called better facilities management, you know, looking for recruitment. So yeah, I mean, if they need the money there, what do they always do? Well, we need to hire business people.
Right.
You know, numbers, run it like a business.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's like at my, so I went to University of Maryland, which is a large East Coast sort of state university system, pretty big. And I've noticed that, I mean, I think it was a great school in the 90s. And it's gone. I mean, it's still a very well-regarded school, you know, like it's a good school. But I've noticed that, like, so much of the campus has gone towards football. Kevin Plank, who is the founder CEO of Under Armour, was a Maryland football player. So he, like, you know, he headquartered his company in Maryland and has this, like, huge public-private partnership with the university. And, you know, we hired this president who is just like, just totally devoted to like raising money, and everything is football. Like everything is football. And then these weird institutes that have nothing to do with like teaching. They're just like research institutions that have their own building, and they've got some kind of partnership with either a company or a large federal government institution. Mm-hmm. And none of this seems like, and you know, the advertising, they'll brag about it in like the magazine that I get, you know, like they send you the magazine.
The alumni mag, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, honestly, none of it is like bread and butter education, you know, like it's not really about undergraduate instruction or graduate doctoral level stuff. It's like bragging about, you know, the new facilities for the football team, or it's bragging about you know, like how big of a turnout they had for this alumni fundraiser event or whatever. And there's, I guess, somewhere just an assumption that all of this is in service to education. But I think what you're saying is like, no, it's sort of like just sort of like a self-replicating expansion of just a revenue stream, you know, and just to justify more of the same, you know, it's like never ending or something.
Yeah.
So go ahead, Chong.
No, I was just gonna just add, it's increasing the value to the shareholders. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So my thought is, the university system is more and more organized like a privately owned firm. And the jargon in this, the standard jargon in academic studies for this is neoliberalization of the university. And I know that's kind of one of these esoteric terms, but it really just means that universities are more and more operating like conglomerates with sports teams, hedge funds, land development projects, public-private partnerships. Teen, when you're talking about those new centers, you know, UConn's got one of these centers for innovation, you know, and it's all about teaming up with local tech companies. And I've never been out to this new building, you know, and that's the land development part. Who knows what's going on in that building? And what that means is that the core functions or the official justification of the university becomes less and less what the upper administrators are actually making decisions about and thinking about and holding endless meetings and emails and Microsoft Teams meetings about. Does this make sense? So it's like all these what seem like for-profit activities actually move to the center, whereas the official justification is that's what is somehow supporting the educational mission.
Right.
Okay. So I think things got flipped around. And I definitely think, you know, going back to Chong's point, that it has something to do with finding new revenue streams and decreased state support, because this links up to the broader so-called neoliberalization of the economy. And all I mean by that is the high point, and I don't want a good old days, the American university, but there were at least better old days. And I would say the highest funding, as well as the highest sort of cultural legitimacy for this institution, was basically the two, maybe two and a half decades, maybe three at the, if we're being generous, after World War II, where basically there was large amounts of these university, you know, University of Texas, Maryland, Wisconsin, California, large amounts of the budgets were coming directly from the state governments. There were also federal funds that were going towards these university systems. This was the period where you were expanding the system. So like the University of California went from like two or three to whatever, six or seven. Okay, and so there was just more to go around. There was just more to go around. And more of it was coming from public funds. So the public goods and the public funds, the idea that everyone was basically benefiting from higher education, that was kind of the model of legitimacy. And with decreased state support, this, of course, gives the management the excuse or the pretense that there is a never-ending financial emergency, and this is why we have to continue spending less on faculty and why we need to get more public-private partnerships, why we need to get more people from the business world into the administration, etc. Okay, so that's definitely part of it. So for me, the legitimacy crisis and the sort of, well, is this institution even about education anymore, or is it being run as a private business? And the decreased public financial support, those go hand in hand for me.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Sorry, look at CUNY. CUNY was free until 1976, and then the state took over its budget, and like you mentioned, the federal support waned as well. You had Pell Grants, Discovery, SEEK, TAP tuition assistance. And then if everything's cut at federal levels, then that's when they started charging tuition for students.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's when administrators, you know, and other professionals just, you know, increased. So I was looking at some job ads on one of these job sites. So just for a second, listen to some of these titles and try not to laugh. Okay. So there's one. So you've heard of this, right? Dean of Institutional Effectiveness, $203,000 a year. Assistant Dean of Student Success and Belonging. And there's also Associate Dean for Inclusive Excellence, Assistant Vice President for Inclusive Excellence and Mission Integration. That's $160,000. Strategic Initiatives Director for Campaigns for Alumni Relations and Development. That's at Northwestern University for $170,000 a year. So I could go on. I mean, some of these just sound like email jobs. I mean, what really is a change management? What is donor experience program manager? And that's for athletics. So you have a whole position created to give donors an experience. This is at Wisconsin. You can imagine what that's like, taking, you know, rich alumni out for three martini lunches. How is this someone's job? And we all know the fact, you know, everyone knows this, that the highest paid state employee in like 40 states.
Oh, it's always the football coach.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. By like a factor of 10. It's like 10 times what the governor makes. Or
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So like, look at these. And there's even a website. It's called universitytitlegenerator.com. And you click on it and it suggests some of these. But these are all real positions. And you think about who's doing the majority of the day-to-day teaching, like who's educating future nurses, you know, future social workers, future speech language pathologists, jobs that make our country go around. And then you've got some guy whose job it is to, you know, donor relations and development operations project coordinator, who's making, I'm not great at math, but like probably making like 10 times what this poor sap who's teaching, you know, a 5-5 load is making. It's just egregious. And I can't believe half this country thinks that schools are woke indoctrination. They're too liberal. I'm like, I just described the definition of, you know, not liberal, the definition of, you know, predatory capitalism or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you ever get the feeling like, Because Fred's talking about this from sort of this neoliberal economic framework, and Chong, you're sort of describing the reality of the educational bureaucracy, which is it's bloated. It's creating it's creating hierarchies and bureaucracies that seem to have no real purpose. Certainly not anything related to what we would typically say is the purpose of a university. Yeah. It almost seems to me like if money was just like high fructose corn syrup, and we've gotten very lazy in our thinking where we know at some broad abstract level that we need like universities to turn out better educated students because the workforce of the future requires, you know, highly educated graduates from STEM and all these other high skill, you know, disciplines. And, you know, like it sounds good on paper, right? Like we need the university system to pump out these highly skilled 21-year-olds and graduates who can plug into the high tech sectors of the future and drive, you know, productivity growth and, you know, enrich the country. And, you know, like that's the story, right? That's the fucking story we hear every day,
yep,
all the time. But the reality is that the only thing that they can do, they being our sort of like higher up political leadership, is just to allocate money to the problem or find other ways to get money into the system. And it's, to me, it's almost just like, it's like taking, it's just like feeding, you know, stuffing this high fructose corn syrup into the body and it just grows more fat. It doesn't, like, there's something about the system, like it's not doing its job. And maybe the neoliberal framework just assumes that if you allocate money to a problem, to an institution, that institution is going to function better. It's going to do its job better. And if it's not doing its job better, it's because there's a lack of money. And I'm not saying that putting money towards the situation is not like we want to starve it of money. I'm not saying that. But I just get the feeling like somewhere along the way, everyone just became money brained and was just like, well, yeah, well, money's going there, so it should be fine. And there's no real planning or execution to say, all right, now that we have resources, how do we actually execute on what we're supposed to do?
Well, we get a director for planning and then 10 consultants.
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Really, that's what would happen if they did that.
Yeah.
It really is. It's the purpose of a system is what it does. I mean, I really think that's what it is. That's what schools are now. And I think I just think we're past the point of no return. Schools, it's dire. It's really dire.
You mean in terms of like the quality of the of its mission, like of educating students?
Right. I mean, now it's about credentialism and experiences. It's right. About yes. giving students experience.
Meaning like the value of the brand name and whether these are four of the best years of your life.
Exactly. Yeah. There you go.
So it's some combination of enhancing human capital and getting those STEM skills and technical knowledges, you know, developed within a certain credential class of college graduates. That's definitely part of it. And then, yeah, the other side of it is the student is consumer, and the consumer has the best years of their life. You're paying for the experience. You know, it's like one of these vacation packages or something. Okay, so that to me is all part of the neoliberalization bit, because when you organize everything like a capitalist market, and that whole that becomes the overriding aim of all your institutions, you know, and so you organize the church like a mega church, okay? You organize the government like a business, you organize the university like a private profit-making institution. Yeah, why would you need humanities? You know, so I know there's a justification for the humanities that basically says humanities graduates earn maybe not as much immediately after graduating, but if you look at the lifetime earnings of a history or philosophy major, it's actually pretty good. Like, I get that. But to me, you've already sort of instrumentalized and basically said the only purpose to study any of these things is because you can go out and make some money with it, which is important and everyone needs to earn. But if you see what I'm saying, like, that's the wrong argument to be making for the value of the humanities. It's a losing battle. You're not going to be able to fight for humanities fundings on those grounds, because you're already fighting on the STEM terrain. So I think that's definitely part of it. And then going back to why are all these fake sounding jobs the only ones that the only sectors of the university that are growing and becoming increasingly rewarded. To me, that's because the university is no longer relatively shielded from these market pressures and these market dynamics. You know, because one of the huge ironies of let's organize everything like a firm is, you know, firms are also full of these bullshit jobs.
Sure.
As well. Yeah. The promise of neoliberalism has always been lean and mean, but you get plenty of mean, but you don't get you don't get lean.
No.
You know, look at right. HR in any yeah. private firm, you know, and are those real jobs?
Right.
And then, of course, and this is a little bit, I don't know if you all know this one, David Graeber, this is the bullshit jobs theory. And his basic idea is it's not a directly economic logic at all as to why there's a provost and then 10 provosts under them. Graeber claims it's more like a feudal logic where you have a little fiefdom within the bureaucracy. And in order to boost the prestige of the higher up, you need underlings, basically. And you need people under your protection, people who are loyal to you. And when you get into these fights for your slice of the university budget, you need, you know, like people who will fight on your side and so forth. So that's one theory of this. And the other piece of this bullshit jobs theory is, this goes back to something Chong was talking about earlier. The people who are doing the most socially useful work get the least remuneration. The people who are not only doing useless work, but creating BS work for the people who are doing useful work are getting the highest financial rewards. It's totally flipped over. So that, I think, is another irony of, you know, well, let's just make everything capitalist, because there seems to be no discernible even correlation between performance and reward. There just doesn't seem, there seems to be an inverse relationship if we're talking about performance in terms of educating people and having anything to do with the supposed mission of the university. So you get a lot of these ironies, and I think a lot of them go, you know, back to how capitalism is ideally supposed to work and how you get these weirdo feudalistic and bureaucratic tendencies when you actually try and run everything along these business school lines.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're right about them creating more work for people. Because if this person is, you know, Office of Student Success, well, you know, they're going to be asking all department chairs to provide, you know, assessment of their, you know, retention, program retention, how many new majors, you know, and so that's work, as you and I both know, that could be spent teaching and tutoring and helping these students. And so, but so when they do cut stuff, like several schools recently have had just astounding levels of cuts. I mean, West Virginia University, I remember reading, lost 28 programs and bread and butter programs, languages, you know, education. So, you know, if you want to train preschool teachers, kindergarten teachers, they cut the program. Some schools just either merge programs, they raise enrollment caps, so you have classes full of like 45 students. They're getting rid of religion, anthropology, just cutting everything. And English departments, I mean, come on, it doesn't get more basic than English. Everyone needs to take English, literature, something, you know. They're kind of moving them into communication studies. So they're like broadening that. So pretty soon a university is going to be like a football team and a business major, an MBA, and a communication studies. That's
and like a real estate hedge fund.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what the school is looking like. And the worst of it are our state schools. CUNY's cutting. They're all cutting. And it's very depressing to work under these conditions, because students learning, our working conditions are students' learning conditions. So think about, you know, you have a bunch of contingent faculty, you have even tenure track positions getting eliminated, mm-hmm. and they don't know if they're going to be teaching this, or they're merging two sections into one, they're doing hiring freezes. I mean, the quality goes down. Nobody can teach at the same level, right, as they would if they had their own office and if they had guaranteed employment the next semester. So it's really like, I teach with a lot of empathy, and I have a lot of empathy for students now. I mean,
yeah, what's the condition of the students? What's the experience like for students entering these public universities? You know, because I went to school from 96 to 2000, and I had a fantastic experience. I really did. I really enjoyed my college years, and I don't know if that's the case anymore, or what is it good? Is it like, what's going on?
Fred, you want to take this one?
Yeah, I'll give it a first shot. So yeah, I went to college in 1997 to 2001. I was at UC Berkeley. Some of the best years of my life, frankly. I was pretty nerdy and pretty sheltered in high school, and I was still nerdy and maybe a little less sheltered in college, but I did feel like, you know, sorry to sound like one of these college brochures, but like, I did feel like the experience was worthwhile.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I did, for the most part, study what I wanted once I just told my parents, no, I'm not getting a physics degree, which is, you know, what they wanted. And I started studying what I wanted, and I started thinking about an academic career. So my sense of it is There is a lot of demoralization. There is a lot of demoralization.
Among the students?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Because, you know, sometimes illusions are not the worst things to have. And, you know, in reality, the function of the university, even in those good old days of high support, high public support and high public funding, the universities were churning out the workforce with the professional, technical, and managerial skills. This is going back to the PMC discussion we were having, team, the other podcast. And yes, they were definitely producing cogs for the larger economic machine. Okay, so there's never been a time when that hasn't been true. Even in the good old days of, you know, public universities expanding and the GI Bill is making college affordable, more affordable than ever, especially for white middle class men. You know, that was demographically what was going on. You're building up an American middle class. Okay, so don't get me wrong, but I kind of get the idea that it wasn't as single-mindedly focused on economic returns on investment, and there was still a little more wiggle room in the so-called good old days where people are like, oh yeah, actually, why don't I get a liberal arts degree? Or why don't I study something that I'll never get a chance to study once I'm out in the workforce, you know, like art history or, you know, a foreign language or comparative literature or just something, you know, that I'm just going to, you know, Japanese history, Korean history, something, you know, that I know is not directly economically useful, but I will find fulfilling. And it's that part of it that I've really seen just so few, you know, feel they can afford to actually pursue their interest and cultivate their, you know, knowledge and, you know,
yeah,
just do what they like, frankly. I think that's gone. I think that's definitely gone. And when it feels like you're just grinding away, in some cases working almost full time and going to classes and maybe commuting from off campus. So at UConn, many students don't have that live in the dorms experience and go to parties or whatever because they're living at home and working a long, right, long hours, you know, and it just feels like another part of the job, you know, and like that's what I think has really, yeah.
Yeah.
An adjunct and an extension of the job market. And so that lack of idealization, I think, is actually part of the demoralization. And of course, this is also part of the demoralization I see in the graduate students right now. Because when I was going to graduate school, and this was 2003, 2010, I was at University of California, Los Angeles. I had so many idealizations, so many illusions. So many, like, I'm pursuing knowledge and I'm seeking truth and all that. Yeah. And then 2008 hits.
And, like I said, the cliff.
The cliff. Because the material support of those idealizations was chance at stable employment and not being forced as a graduate student to teach my own classes, which is a huge ask and totally slows down graduation time. This is what's going on at my own institution, you know, and not to bite the hand that feeds me or whatever, but it's not, this is so, the material conditions are so far from ideal.
Yeah.
No one can even, they don't feel they have the luxury to be idealistic about any of this.
Yeah. You know,
Go ahead.
I was just going to concur deeply. I mean, like, when's the last time you met a freshman who was undeclared? You just don't see anyone. They roll into school with, they already know what they want to do. Like, I'm not just saying what they want to study, but what they actually, like, what job they want to get placed in. It's like a bingo, you know, the thing with the balls in it that you turn and the balls come cranking out and they get put somewhere. And and so to go back to like our college experiences, I also had a blast from 98 to 2002. I did two study abroads. I waited tables. I met good friends. I mean, yeah, I studied, but I also, you know, it didn't even occur to me. I mean, I know this is naive and I wish I could go back.
Where were you at, by the way?
Oh, yeah. I went to University of Dallas. It's a small Catholic liberal arts school. Mm-hmm. I got recruited because I was a classics major because I got a perfect score on the Latin Olympiad 2 years in a row.
Oh, fancy. Yeah. Fancy.
But anyway, so yeah, I had a blast. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And that is something, like, I haven't met a student yet who doesn't know. And, you know, I joke sometimes with my students, you know, I teach writing also at Fordham. And so sometimes I joke, I say, well, don't end up like me, you know, learn to code. And I am just kidding. But you're right, Fred, that this idealism, it's just not happening anymore. And students come in with ideas about getting a job. And you're right. I mean, they don't have time unless they're forced by some core curriculum requirement. They don't have time to explore stuff. They're not going to take, you know, especially languages, because they're getting rid of language requirements. Partially, guess what? It's to save money, right? It's so they don't have to hire people to teach the classes. It's so they don't have to, so they can use the department and the offices for the donor experience program manager that I mentioned. So yeah, it is, everything is like self-justifying in the end. So
I was going to say, we all seem to have gone to college, I think, where we rounded a bend somehow. Like, by my time in college, I seem to be older than both of you. We started getting like undergraduates going into the business school. And we started getting on-campus interview was like a major thing. Corporations would come to school and you would, you know, throw into the campus interview lottery. And the whole career center part of the school started to become really big. And that was an interface with corporate America. And that started to really pick up during the dot-com boom. When I was in college, like, everyone wanted to be at a startup or wanted to go to Silicon Valley, and like that's when it started. And but still, I think you're right, Fred, that there was still this sense that although there was all this like corporatized activity going on in the sort of like IT part sectors of the business school and maybe the computer science and engineering programs to an extent, those sort of like professional track programs were sort of underwriting they were sort of subsidizing the rest of the school where people were doing, you know, traditional learning and humanities and liberal arts. And I think, do you remember there was a really famous, I think this is when you could tell things were turning a little bit towards what we have now. Do you remember Steve Jobs gave a very famous commencement speech at Stanford where he talked about like these critical junctions in his life path towards becoming Steve Jobs? And one of the famous stories he told was how he went to Reed College, I think, in Portland.
Oh, yeah.
And he wasn't degree. He just was there to fuck around and have fun. And he audited a calligraphy class. And he learned all these calligraphy methods and stuff. And he said, I didn't know why. I just thought it was really cool. I didn't know until later that what I learned in that calligraphy class would be crucial to the development of fonts, typefaces in the Mac computer. And so that was his message, is like, think about it. It's like the reason you want to just do sort of like learning in and of itself is because we don't have a way of pinpointing which one of these things is going to be economically important, or to, you know, like, you don't know which one of these is going to be the lottery ticket that gets you to build the mech. So you have to go out and you have to learn a wide range of things, because you never know which one is going to be really important in, you know, you constructing a company or whatever. And I think that's kind of like the sort of bend, like that's the intermediate step where Steve Jobs is starting to sort of say all learning ultimately is in service of entrepreneurship. You know, it's all in service, ultimately, even sort of like learning in its own right. You know, the universe will conspire in mystical ways so that it will reward your learning with commercial applications of what you learned. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? And it was subtle. It was subtle because I thought it was actually a really neat story.
Was you know? He learning Western calligraphy, Chinese calligraphy?
I think it was like, you know, like Gothic calligraphy.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So he's not like Walt Whitman, you know, when I heard the learned astronomer prattling on, I'm just appreciating the stars. He's saying, well, you never know when you can monetize something that you learned.
There is this sort of like weird spiritual, like there's a weird entrepreneurial spiritualism to Steve Jobs as a figure at that time, where it was like the reason you want to be, because he really embodied the spirit, I think, of like that sort of that free, sort of like a hippie culture, but like, you know, he was really into psychedelics. He was from Northern California. He, you know, was a vegan and he didn't wear shoes and stuff. And he was just like, he was a weird guy. He was a free thinker. He embodied free thinking. But ultimately the universe would, all of it was ultimately a conspiracy by the universe for you to discover how to commercialize all this shit. You know, it was crazy. Yeah.
This is very reminiscent for me of, you know, you'll see these AI guys talking about this because they'll say, you know, with the development of AI, don't learn coding. Our computers are going to do the coding. Go learn the humanities. And in fact, because, you know, on similar justifications, because the humanities are supposed to give you more breadth. They're supposed to give you general thinking skills. They're supposed to, you know, teach not, you know, expertise, but, you know, how to think in general. And that's what's going to be useful for the market. The Steve Jobs thing is fascinating. It's a fascinating channeling of countercultural impulses into Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And turning what you know, typically this kind of romantic, free thinking, spiritual, seeking spiritual transcendence type, at least in the Western traditions, and you know, this is true of Taoists, for example, in China and so forth, is supposed to be anti-establishment, right? And against business and against, you know, the profit making, you know, world and all this. And he somehow redirected those energies and says, you can have it both, you know, you have your cake and eat it too. You can have the spiritual transcendence and you can also be the CEO of Apple. And I think that was also his way of marketing and selling Apple as an educational computer. You know, I don't know if you all had the Apple IIs.
I grew up programming that thing, yeah.
Yeah, same, mm-hmm. same. So in the 80s, we were all learning AppleSoft Basic, you know, and that same appeal, I think, really worked with the Mac market as well, and it explains its popularity among designers.
Think different.
Yeah.
The rainbow, not like this business, you know, IBM stuff. It's definitely think out of the box.
That was the genius of Apple. They were able to really position themselves as anti-corporate. They were ready. They could co-opt all of the idealism around, I don't even want to, of this counterculture, which I think had roots in the university campus, and somehow, channel it into the most corporate way imaginable, you know. And you know what's so interesting is, speaking of Steve Jobs, because I think he's such an outsized figure in all this, to be honest. I remember when I was in law school, we had on-campus interviews to get where you would, you know, find out which law firm you know you'd be working for after you graduate. And they had us go to like this Hilton or something in Midtown, and this was a big day. Like this was a big, you know, this is a big event. You know what I mean? And so you have your sort of base camp in one of the ballrooms, and all the students are there looking pretty. And you start realizing, oh, okay, so my law school is sort of like a finishing school, and it's like, you know, they're trying to teach you how to be sexy and cute for the, you know, like to be a courtesan for these high powered law firms that's going to choose which one of you they want to take and groom. And you would literally go into you go into a hotel room, and then you would knock on the door, and a middle-aged man would open the door into a hotel room. And there would be, I remember specifically the firm I interviewed with, it was a middle-aged man, and it was a double bed room, and he sat on one bed and I sat on the other. And I mean, talk about on the nose. I was like,
we do that.
I'm a call man.
We do that.
I'm a call dude. This is a, I'm a, you know, I'm making a call here. This is a, you know, I'm a prostitute, right?
Room service.
You're a gigolo.
Yeah, I'm a gigolo.
Room service.
Yeah. I'm a man whore.
We do that in humanities. It the Modern Languages Association every January. That's how I got to visit, you know, Chicago and Seattle, all these different cities. But it's the same thing. I mean, it's a meat market.
Meat market.
It's a meat market. Yeah. You're wearing an ugly suit that you bought, you know, at Ann Taylor or Banana Republic with your meager grad income, right? You're wearing an ugly suit and you're standing in a hallway by an elevator. You don't want to knock on the door, you know, late, but you don't want to be too early, and you're standing there, and like you said, you knock on the door, you have your interview, and yeah, it's a horrible process. But speaking of, you know, interviews and jobs, I mean, another thing with students, we mentioned that they don't have this freedom anymore to study what they want and to take risks. Now, like Fred mentioned, a lot of them are working. I mean, now they have all these internships. So I feel like half of what these students are doing is doing stuff to put on their CV or resume. And it's just job after job after job. And you wouldn't believe how long some of these students' resumes are. They're doing summer internships. They're doing fall internships. And it's not just like study abroad for 1 year or even just a semester. They're working at these big companies. Like at one of the schools I teach at, you know, they're working for Ernst & Young or, you know, Deloitte, and they're getting these prestigious internships. They're networking all the time. It's almost like they're just mini workers. It's not, you know, it's not like it was when we were in college, where maybe you would do an internship if you had rich parents and you'd like shadow somebody for a summer. I mean, it's completely just bizarre. And like I said, I empathize with these students because it's a miserable job market. It's a miserable college market. Everything is miserable right now. Everything.
Yeah, it really is. And I could feel it. I could feel it happening, you know, like even back then. I just something that just didn't feel right. It didn't feel good to me that our university, or my law school was putting so much focus on this day. And I was like, this is a truly disgusting day. I was like, I feel like a I don't feel good.
You need a shower.
Yeah, yeah. I did. It was really awful. And, you know, okay, so here's the thing. I think that that day, the reason it felt really awful was like, I could tell immediately then that the university, the academy, you know, and you go, I was at Columbia for this. And then, you know, you go to Columbia and it's like, I mean, it's so grandiose, like the way it talks about itself, and it's got these grand buildings, you know, with, you know, all the, you know, classical scholars' names on Butler Library and these statues and stuff. And then you're like, oh, this is what it really is. You could see that at that point, the way that corporate power had the academy by the balls, right? Mm-hmm. And there was I brought up Steve Jobs because there was a really famous dinner that he that was hosted for Obama when Obama was president, towards the second administration. They had a big tech dinner. All the, you know, Eric Schmidt, Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs, they were all there. And this was meant to be, you know, this is when DC, the establishment was starting to recognize the national importance of Silicon Valley. And so Obama goes out there and Obama asks Steve Jobs, he's next to Steve Jobs, and he asks him, you know, what is it? I'm the president. What can I do to help you bring the iPhone? Because already at this point, people are like, how come the iPhone can't be made here? Remember, even Mac computers were manufactured in the United States, right? So the idea that Apple would do all of its manufacturing in China was still kind of a weird and new idea, even in Obama's eras. By this point, we don't even question that. And so Obama said, like, what can I do? I'm the president. What can I do to help the situation, because I want to bring those jobs back? And Steve Jobs basically told him they're not coming back. And the reason they're not coming back is because the educational system isn't providing me the kind of worker that I need. And, you know, that it just basically said to the message to Obama was the educational system in America from K through graduate school exists to meet my demands as an industrialist. And if it's not, if you can't make that happen, then I'm going to move my factory over to China and I'm not going to hire any Americans. And, you know, we see how that's gone in the past decade plus. I mean, this is an existential crisis for us now. And all the meaningful productive work has moved overseas because the corporations had a fit and said, your university system isn't providing me the kind of people that I want, you know? And so I'll just do the obvious thing, which is I'll just move all my shit overseas to China where they are doing it, where they are producing the people that I want. And it's just sad. I don't know. It's a sad development. And this view that the corporation can just kind of throw a fit because the educational system isn't producing the skills that they need out of the box. Whereas, by the way, I know I'm ranting a little bit, but I think it changed its name, but there is a school in Detroit. It's an accredited engineering university. It grants 4-year degrees and stuff that was called General Motors University. And its origin was GM wanted engineering workers. It wanted, you know, advanced engineers in the automotive arts, right? And the school system wasn't producing this because this stuff was really advanced and new. And so GM just built its own university. and I was like, we don't do that. There's no app, you know, Apple's not going to create a university to churn out the engineers that it claims it needs. It's just going to dump it on the educational system and say, make it. And if you don't make it, then I'm going to China where they will make it. And what a bunch of fucking assholes. Basically, it's, you know,
it's an allegory for the broader trend of how private interests are able to use public power to get what they want without paying for it. You know, this is, I think, exactly the point. If this is about training the next generation of workers for Apple and the other multinational corporations, throwing a hissy fit to Obama, trying to get the president, who, I mean, the president can't do any, you know, Obama can't do anything about this. But maybe he can encourage universities to start producing the kinds of workers that Steve Jobs claims are keeping him from keeping his production facilities.
Yeah.
But why doesn't Apple, what am I saying? Why doesn't Apple go and do it? I mean, how is the university system supposed to predict what the needs of Apple are? What Apple should just
exactly because they don't
they have so much
pay
fucking
it.
Money. Open a university and train the engineers yourself.
I'm actually glad that corporations can't. Well, look, if they want to have their own training facility or you know their own degree program, but I'm really glad that corporations can't dictate what to teach.
Oh no, but I mean literally, like open a trade school. So that people who want to go work at Apple, like, you know, don't, you know, just go to fucking Apple University and they'll train you in how to make iPhones. And that's great. I don't see a problem with this, but.
And they won't have a football team and they won't have associate director for bullshit, right? It'll just be like what you need. No, I think that's fine. It kind of reminds me of what Vivek said, Vivek Ramaswamy, when he was criticizing American students for not being, you know, prepared. They're not studying enough. It's like full circle. And I think it's probably
we're talking H-1B visa. Sorry, John.
Yeah, no, right. When he said that, this is why we need foreign workers is because Americans are too lazy.
That's a hot topic. Like, can I propose something?
Yeah.
We're about an hour. I don't know how you guys are feeling, but like we could flip this into like a second part bonus pod if this is a good inflection point, but if your timing it works out, we could do that.
Happy to do it.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So we'll continue this discussion, including the Ramaswamy, the Vivek statement, which was a interesting statement.
Right.
It was,
he also said something, I don't know if it was like today or recently. He said he was talking about, so he said, like, quote, electricians, welders, mechanics, carpenters, I don't call these trades. I call them professionals. They deserve respect. You know, it's not like one path is more elite. They're all elite. So it's funny that, I mean, of course, he's like appealing to the Joe the plumber crowd. But I actually think there's something behind this. Not, you know, I also think, you know, all of these trades, these professionals are of course very valued. In fact, they make more than I could ever make, right? Some of them. But I think this is like the back doorway to further plunder state budgets for humanities education and for universities in general. And for someone so slimy, like
super,
Vivek,
super slimy.
Yeah, I mean he's a swindler, and for him to stand there and say, oh well, you know these trades are so blah blah. It's just such bullshit. It just makes me so mad to hear
all
this.
Right. So we'll continue. Well, we should definitely continue that on.
Oh, okay.
The next. Well, if you want to hear that part, just go to the patreon.com/planningmag, and you get access to bonus pods. All right.